Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's our Rethink the Week, so we have a great panel of guests for the next hour. But before we grab our guests, we grab Lieutenant Colonel Vindman and his powerful testimony during the impeachment hearings of 2019, something we've been doing every single day for months, something we will continue to do for weeks until the election of November 2020. I'm not quite sure when we're going to get resolution of that election, but we will end on Election Day, November 2020, because I do want his voice in your head when you exercise the franchise, whether it's in person, whether it's by absentee ballot, or whether it's by vote by mail. The most important word here is you vote. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
All right, gang. We Zoom on Sunday afternoon. So if something should happen Sunday night, we're not going to be talking about it till Tuesday. But this is our Rethink the Week. So we're going to sort of rehash everything that happened and a little bit of anticipation about what is going to happen this upcoming week. Joining me, as he always does, is Dean Spiliotis. He is a professor of civic engagement and a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. You hear him regularly on New Hampshire Public Radio. He also has a blog, nhpoliticalcapital.com. Welcome to the program, Dean.
Hi, Arnie. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you. Rick Newman, I have known him. God, Rick, I think it's almost going on 40 years now. Rick Newman is a former state legislator in New Hampshire. He also is a former Canadian. Do you have dual citizenship, Rick? Out of curiosity?
In Canada's eyes, I do. The United States doesn't recognize.
Okay. And he also is a lobbyist and someone who is does a great analysis of what's happening in politics today in America as well as locally. Welcome back to the program, Rick.
Thank you, Arnie.
And Bob Hennelly is a prolific, let me use the operative word again, prolific writer. You can find him at Stuck Nation. You can read his pieces at Salon.com. He also writes for InsiderNJ.com. And he also is with the Chief Leader, which covers sort of the public sector unions in New York. Let me welcome Bob Hennelly back to the program. How are you, Bob?
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. So we have to talk about last week. I mean, we didn't know what to expect. And I think it served its purpose. But I saw an interesting take at the New Republic. And I wanted to share like a couple of sentences from there because I think it offers a fascinating window in on what they were trying to accomplish. And here's what the title is from the New Republic, gentlemen. It's by Alex Shepard. Joe Biden has found his big idea. It's not just about defeating Donald Trump, but providing an off-ramp from this all-consuming political moment. And then I will go into the piece and pull out a couple of sentences. Although there was much hand-wringing about how it would work, the unique aesthetics of the virtual convention actually went a long way in helping to shape this dynamic, the idea of the off-ramp, and smooth over some of the more jarring disconnections and contradictions. The overall feel of the proceedings resembled an odd but strangely pleasant mashup of, ready, an infomercial, the Grammys, AM radio, and a Zoom call with extended family. I think that's brilliant. I thought that sounds like, that's exactly what it was. It was an affable, jaunty ride that encapsulated the core themes of Biden's campaign. So damned normcore that arguing with its wholesomeness seems petty. The issue that dominated the Democratic primary during its pre-coronavirus period animated the convention. Gun violence, climate change, racial justice, gender equality were just some of the issues that swam to center stage. But these matters, once live issues argued about during debates, were depoliticized here. With their complicated edges sanded off, the existence of political forces beyond Trump that might take issue with the Democratic position was forgotten entirely, stuffed into the memory hole. Instead of settling the raucous debate about how Joe Biden will solve the problems that were wrestled during the primary, we were treated to moving videos that pulled at the heartstrings. And basically what he goes on to say is that what Joe Biden's approach to politics is, he's going to rely on his deep reservoir of empathy, assert his get the job done reputation, and as Bill Clinton testified in his convention speech, lead with feelings, unlike Trump, offer positive vibes only. And I'm thinking, I have to tell you that he kind of nails it, because all those raw edges were kind of worn off me too. I kind of watched it and went, that was charming. That was nice. That was sweet. I think I really like Kamala. Joe did a decent job. He was gave a good speech. I mean, everything about it was almost not political. It was obviously not Trump, but it was about something that I'd forgotten what it was like, which was to listen to a speech and not have to fact check it for every lie, not have to be exhausted by its racism and its misogyny, not have to think, how the hell did he get here? But kind of say, huh, not so bad. So I'm going to start with you, Rick Newman, because you're usually the persnickety one on this panel. What was your reaction to this four-day event? And did it accomplish the task that was set before them, obviously, to sort of bring whatever pieces of the party together and to, more importantly, sort of lay a foundation of contrast between the GOP and the Democratic Party?
Well, you know, I've said for a while that, and a lot of people disagree with me, but I really believe that the country essentially needs a big hug. And I think we got a big hug from Joe Biden and the Democratic Party last week. And I don't say that, you know, tritely. I mean, I just think that we all know we've lived 3.5 years of what seems to be never ending chaos. There's always something crazy going on. There's always lies being told. And all of these things that have happened, that we can't even remember 80% of them anymore. And what Biden reminded us of was decency and normal, what normal used to be. And when you combine not just this whole Trump factor, but this COVID thing that we've had to deal with or live through, that none of us remember, you know, we've never had anything like this.
No.
Yeah. The country doesn't feel safe right now. And I think Biden made people believe that he could make them safe.
So, Bob, as I'm listening to Rick, I think we are exhausted. Those of us who pay attention and actually care about science, care about the facts, care about truth, don't want to hate people because of their color, don't want people to hate people because of their faith, don't want to hate people because, I mean, the laundry list of hate that comes out of this man is just, it's mind-blowing. I just saw a statistic. This is unbelievable, everyone. And that is, the question was asked, do you think that there have been too many deaths from this pandemic, or do you think that this is about what to have expected? The Democrats, by 90%, say there have been too many deaths. The Republicans say by about 49%, there have been too many deaths. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. And you know, I'm looking at that number, and I have to tell you, Bob, one of the reasons I think the number is so jarring is that I think the Republican Party has become the white supremacy party, and therefore they look at the people that die, and they figured, they're Black. They're Hispanic. They have underlying health conditions, and they cost us too much money anyway. It's not me. And so in a lot of ways, the numbers don't touch them. And when they hear who dies, it sort of fits into their headset. Well, it's my country anyway. So anyway, I'm kind of curious, do we need a hug, or do we need not only a hug, but we need what Bill Clinton said, a bridge to the future?
Well, I thought that Rick said it all really succinctly with the country does not feel safe. And so there has to be, it's a Tai Chi of, you do have to have some kind of collective grieving, but mobilization at the same time.
Yes.
And give people a sense of urgency. And so I really enjoyed seeing this generation of young people that are relatively obscure. I mean, dozens of them running and holding state offices, holding, you know, second and third bench people back in the Democratic Party. That's a deep bench, and it does make you feel hopeful when you see the likes of Kristen Urquiza, who said that whose father had died from Arizona, whose father had died from COVID, and was a real ardent Trump supporter. And she says, looking in the camera, my dad's only precondition was faith in Donald Trump. That stays with people. Yeah. So I think that they accomplished a lot. And in the process, also, even the roll call, and I was sad because this would have been my fifth cycle I wouldn't be able to go to in person, right? So I was really looking forward to it. But the way they did that around the United States, the geography and the territories, with those authentic responses from all the people there, I mean, I don't ever remember anything like that. So I think it was a big win.
So actually, so Dean, I'm thinking, you know, like in Norway, I know exactly what they would be wearing if they went around Norway. And if they went to like France, I know exactly what they'd be wearing. They'd be holding up their fromage or their whatever, their baguette. And then I'm looking at America and I'm thinking, oh my God, it's a smorgasbord. Look at this. The ethnicity, the richness, the color, the difference. It was like, it was just, we hear about it, but what they did visually was show it to us. And in the end, that is the greatest contrast between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. Because the Republican Party, I mean, the first announcement was it's going to be like half family members that are talking. So now it's, you know, the Trump cabal. And, you know, and yet I looked at what they produced, and what they produced was, as Rick said, not only a hug, but it was a hug with such variety and accents and flavors and colors that there wasn't something you didn't want to sort of appreciate.
Yeah, I have about a half dozen different things I would want to comment on here, but I'll just try to pick a few of them initially. You know, in the past, Republicans would have gone or been at great pains to try to match the diversity that you typically see at a Democratic National Convention. I don't know that they necessarily will attempt to do that this time, because it's pretty clear that that's really no longer their core constituency. They're no longer really competing for African-American votes or Latino votes for the most part, although there are some. But they've seemed to almost kind of given up on the pretext of matching the diversity of the Democratic Party. And you saw that on display wonderfully at the convention. You know, I think the Democratic Party was in a difficult position, being unable to have a live convention. It was uncharted territory. I think they unintentionally stumbled onto some aspects of the format that worked quite well, that were quite intimate. You didn't have the obligatory constant applauding from the floor of the convention. You didn't have people talking in that annoying podium voice they get when they give their speeches. I get tired after 10 hours of that. So it was nice to hear this sort of intimacy,
yes,
you know, much more modulated presentation. Yes. You know, their goal really were two things. One, to show kind of a maximum size of the Democratic tent and bring in as many people as possible, both on the left and in the center. And also really to make a very personal case against Donald Trump. You know, one of the few things you're starting to see take shape now is a Republican rebuttal that says, you know, they didn't spend any time talking about policy because the reality is Joe Biden will be captive to the progressive wing of the party, and Kamala Harris is going to be the conduit to AOC and the rest of the squad. And so that's the argument, one of the arguments we're going to hear this mm-hmm. coming week in what is being promoted as a very upbeat convention. I've seen the list of speakers. A couple campaign aides have said there were going to be some big surprises. I don't see any on the list. Maybe we will be surprised. I don't know, but it's pretty much the usual suspects. And, you know, a little bit of a nod to diversity, but not much.
Ken, you want to weigh in?
Yes, please. Thank you. I hate to be the Debbie Downer here in this group. I agree with what everybody's been saying, because I felt good throughout it all. I felt the big hug. I loved the diversity, all the authenticity, and especially the comparison of Biden's decency and empathy and relating to real human beings and not just kowtowing to the very wealthy cronies. That was all great. But then when it was over, I felt like I had just watched a romantic comedy, you know, and there's no substance there. It's all this feel-good stuff without any real themes. And Arnie was talking earlier at the beginning about there were no arguments about this and that.
The rough edges were all sanded off, I know.
Exactly. Well, you know what? They didn't talk about policy.
You know what they didn't talk about? I mean, they didn't talk about corporate America. They didn't talk about banking. They didn't talk about finances. They didn't talk about any of those things, which is really where the Democratic Party hemorrhages between the new Dems and the liberal Dems is, you know, how are we going to handle Wall Street and what are we going to do about monopolies? I mean, but this is a convention. This is a convention. Is this the place to start playing out the monopoly story and the antitrust story? I don't think so.
So let me throw out a quick. Quick question. And I don't have the answer to this, but this is what Ken is getting at. Is what I was suggesting at the tail end of my comments will be part of the Republican rebuttal. The question is, if Joe Biden and Kamala Harris had talked about, tax increases, rolling back tax cuts, Green New Deal, expanded, Medicare for all, is that a winning proposition in the general election? Or is it a problematic proposition? And I think there are some folks in the Biden campaign who believe that they got to keep that stuff under wraps because they're going to alienate independents and suburban Republicans if they do that.
Here's what I love what the Democrats did, Bob. What I think the Democrats did was kind of a Rorschach test. And therefore, you got to say, oh, they talked enough about, climate change for me to feel like maybe they're going to go in that direction. They talked enough about, it was almost like you could pull little tiny pieces out of some of the things that people said and think they were talking to you. That's how I felt. But there was one word that was used that's really used, and that's why I'm going to you, Bob, the word union. They used the word union during that convention in a way that I have not heard used before. And you write a lot about unions. In fact, your most recent piece talks about, the frontline workers who basically are going to die because they are expendable. And one of the reasons why they're more likely to die, unfortunately, is because they're not organized and protected by a union that would set a higher standard for worker safety. Right. Now you have to trust Donald Trump, which you can't. You have to trust your employer, which you probably can't either. And as a result, not only are they always vulnerable because they're not protected by a union, but now they're triply vulnerable because they have a pandemic to deal with.
Yeah, the union part was really important. Yes. But what was fascinating was there was a parallel universe, which is even more militant, that I was also monitoring simultaneously, of these Zoom meetings and other things that were ancillary to the main event, which didn't get much coverage. So it was very similar to what you used to see in the in-place conventions, where you would have, in person, there were always collateral events other places. We had a similar thing happen with this, where you did see things that were hard-hitting and issue-based. But generally, I think that we're in uncharted territory. You have to go back to 1918, and there was no mass broadcast communications on this scale. So you have a mass death event where the United States, once a superpower, has been reduced to third world status. And you're going to have a lot of people, just because of the nature of how the media landscape has been upset. I mean, life itself has been upset. You're going to have people looking at the TV who probably didn't think they were political. So I think that the idea of having this more as an impression thing, more as a touchy-feely gestalt, was a way of, particularly before Labor Day, to get a second look from people that weren't even engaged in politics, but might be thinking, this is really bad. I better pay attention.
Absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. All right. So, Rick, I'm going to you. So you want to end this topic about the Democratic Convention, because I want to then segue into what's going to happen next week with the Trump National Convention. I can't even call it a Republican National Convention.
I got you. I just two quick comments. Shout out to New Hampshire. Braden Harrington, the 13-year-old.
Right.
What an amazing kid. What an amazing thing that he did. And what a contrast. And showing the contrast of what Joe Biden did regarding him and his speech issue versus the memory of Donald Trump making fun of that
reporter
4 years ago.
Yeah.
Also want to, as a former 19-year-old state representative myself over 40 years ago, I want to give a shout out to Representative Denny Ruprecht, who was elected at 19 years old and gets to speak at the Democratic National Convention. And what an amazing story that is. And it says something to what Bob said earlier about how the Democrats spanned the generations and brought attention to the young people that we have in the party.
So, Rick, before we get into the Republican convention, I'm glad you brought up the young Mr. Harrington from New Hampshire, who has the stutterer, who got to know Joe Biden, who got to connect with him in an incredible way, and the kind of courage it took for him to get up there and give his talk. So I tweeted out that for me, the most memorable moments, to some extent, in that convention were Gabby Giffords and him. And the reason was both of them had great difficulty finding the words. All right, think about that. They said that Giffords worked for months to be able to give that speech because she had to learn new words because she doesn't have them yet in her vocabulary and she wanted to master them so she could speak. And then you see the young man from New Hampshire and you have to, it just, in a way, that's what was so powerful. I'm watching, you know, former Congressman Giffords and I'm crying because I'm thinking, wow, look at that. What an amazing comeback. And then you heard how hard she had to work to give that speech. And you're actually even more enthralled. So I just want to sort of touch on those two amazing moments. Okay, Rick.
Don't forget Barkin. Don't forget Addie Barkin.
Oh, Addie Barkin as well. You're right. Addie Barkin as well. And he has to speak through a computer. Oh, my God. If you want something to touch on your heartstrings, those three were the trifecta, you guys. It played with me. I'll admit it. So Rick, I posted on Facebook a question. And the question is, so what do you think the theme is going to be for the Republican convention? I have gotten the most hilarious bunch of answers. You know, the typical one that usually comes from Texas, if you ain't indicted, you haven't been invited. That was one of them. And then the other one of them, mine was, if you ain't white, you ain't right. And that was one. And then I looked at, again, at the New Republic, and here was one, the Republican National Convention's Carnival of White Grievance. And I think the operative word is white. And then again, it is going to be about how horrific everything is going to be if Joe Biden gets elected, Rick.
Well, isn't, and I mean, this isn't an original thought for me. I've read this many places in the last, you know, couple of weeks. I mean, you know, Trump is talking about, we're going to have chaos. We're going to have violence in the streets. We're going to have job, you know, people going to lose their jobs. Hey, Donald, that stuff's happening right now. It's happening. I mean, don't watch.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I mean, are you telling us that it's just going to get, how could it get worse? Remember 4 years ago when he said, what have you got to lose?
Yeah, your life.
Talk about setting yourself up. I mean, when Ronald Reagan said to Jimmy Carter, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? And a lot of people in the country said, no, I'm not.
Yeah.
And they voted for Reagan, you right. know. And now you've got this guy who's saying, they literally ran an ad showing violence in the streets that happening today, and saying this is what will happen when Joe Biden gets elected. It's almost beyond comprehension that their political professionals can be so stupid.
Well, no, but I don't think they're stupid. So let me tell you, Dean, the reason he does that is that once again he doesn't own any problem, Donald Trump. Donald Trump doesn't own anything for the lack of testing. Donald Trump doesn't own anything for the race riots. Donald Trump doesn't own anything for what's going on. So therefore, all the bad stuff that he is pointing to, he is blaming, you know, Black Lives Matter. He is blaming the Democrats. So he's showing this as if this is happening, but it's not my fault, it's their fault. And if they're in charge, imagine how much worse it's gonna get. And that is his deflection, which he is a master of.
He has no interest in running as an incumbent defending an institutional record. He's not interested in that. He's running the same way he ran in 16 and in the way he tried to help out in 18 with the midterm elections. And it worked in 16, but not so much in 18. You know, he wants to run as an outsider, as a challenger. You know, he had that famous phrase, I take no responsibility. So the idea of in the words of social media, he's really self-owning himself. He's laying out all these horrible scenarios, all of which are taking place under his presidency. And historically, when that's the case, you get punished by voters when you stand for re-election. But the whole concept of defending his incumbency and performance in office. It's not him. It's not what he does. It's not what he likes to do. He feels much more comfortable coming from as an outsider with no connection to whatever is happening on the ground.
So he has to run against himself, and that's
basically
now he's running against two people. He's running against Joe Biden and he's running against himself.
And he is, and he kind of likes that because that separates him from himself. Yeah. No. He's the only person who can separate him from himself. So Bob, I mean, I can't even, this is going to be made for TV Week, because my understanding is not only did they not know what they were doing until like yesterday, because they're pulling this out of their socks, but it turns out that they're bringing in the producers from The Apprentice to help him out. I'm thinking, okay, there's going to be a lot of "you're fired" on this show. But I mean, this is kind of shocking, but here's what I want to know. Why the hell is Joni Ernst from Iowa, the senator who's already in a very risky position, willing to be one of the sort of keynote speakers this week? Does this help Joni? Joni doesn't have to win a primary. Joni has to win her freaking state. And her state is in like real disrepair, not just from COVID, what's happening with the agricultural industry, and frankly, what's happening as a result of climate change. Why would she want that kind of attention, Bob?
Because she has to dance with the people that brought her to the dance. Just now, as you were speaking, the Hill moved something. 3 in 4 Republicans say U.S. is in better shape than 4 years ago. So there is this altered state that exists there. And Trump will bring forward like this Alice Marie Johnson, who was involved with cocaine trafficking. She was a federal prisoner, distinguished herself in humanitarian concerns. And he, of course, you know, got her out of jail. He is going to try to make a case that he was doing this great thing and that COVID, you know, the drill, China interrupted it. And so he in some ways is still
the Wuhan virus. Yes,
he's still running as the pirate in the flagship. It's the crazy thing he's been able to do. And so he's like, well, we can't do great things because this media cabal is still frustrating us. And the thing I would watch out for is that there is the inability of the federal government to have a coordinated public health strategy and to support the states and the counties and the cities. There's going to be an awful lot of economic dislocation that's going to be happening before the election. And yes. I don't think people are aware of the velocity of it.
Yes.
And so we don't have national reporting paying attention to the municipal layoffs. We already have 1.5 million. De Blasio, a progressive Democrat, is preparing to lay off 22,000. If this thing gets going, and then you have the PBA in New York City endorsing Trump, really it's anyone's call as to how this lava lamp resolves itself.
It is a lava lamp, Rick, because as I'm listening to Bob, I'm thinking about it, and I don't know what the schools are doing around the country, but a lot of them are going on, you know, exclusively online. And I said this on Friday morning when I was doing a conservative radio show. And I said, so let me tell you what online means. It's not only crazy for teachers. It's not only crazy for parents, because how do you work? Do you find the daycare? Who's going to come in and step in, work with your kids while they're going to school, assuming you still are somewhat employed? But what about the layoff of the bus drivers? What about the layoff of the cafeteria workers? What about the layoff of the custodians? Think of all the support staff that are supportive of making a school function on a daily basis. But that's the brick and mortar school, Rick. Now what's happening, as they're making that option for online and all online, that's going to be another example of who is suddenly going to find themselves unemployed, Rick.
Yeah, look, we're in a conundrum there. You know, health versus all the other things that go along with, you know, in-house learning. And I do not envy the people that have to make those decisions. But those decisions should be made by professionals, and they shouldn't be made by Joe Biden, and they shouldn't be made by Donald Trump, or they shouldn't be made by politicians. They should be made by people who know something about what they're doing.
And on that note, I need to go to a break. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's our Rethink the Week with Rick Newman, Robert Hennelly, and Dean Spiliotis. We'll be right back.
Flew in from Miami Beach, B-O-A-C. Didn't get to bed last night. On the way to paper. the USSR. Well, the great girls really knocked me out.
Welcome back to Part 2 of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Rethink the week. Well, it was actually, it did feel like a week. I have to admit this, everyone, because it was the Democratic Convention and it sort of began on Monday and ended on Thursday. And there was almost a bit of like a bubble of normalcy. It does feel like we can sort of talk in a cogent way about rethink the week, unlike what normally happens, which feels like rethink the decade. So joining us is Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University, Rick Newman, a former state representative and a lobbyist, and Robert Hennelly, who is at Stuck Nation, writes for Salon.com, InsiderNJ.com, and the chief leader. So I want to go to you, Dean. As I was talking about sort of the number of people who are now going to suddenly be unemployed because schools are going back, because colleges are going back, but they're going back in a different form. And that different form means that there'll be less need for certain support staff. There's going to be a total sort of change in the deck chairs on the sinking Titanic, because everyone is scared about what's going to work and what's not going to work. So they don't want to let people go because they may be calling them back. They don't need them. So how do they keep them on the payroll? All those things are happening. But one of the things I want to mention, and you heard it from Bob about the fact that we're going to see, I think, another spike in unemployment, is that we also have two other events that are happening that deal with climate change. And that is what we are seeing happening in California, which is beyond horrific, Dean. And what kind of scares me is, remember the last time we saw these horrific fires in California? It was 24/7 covering the fires. These fires are as bad, if not worse. And because of the politics, we're not covering how horrific they are. And then we're looking at the dual possible hurricanes coming into Louisiana and Texas. And we haven't seen anything like this, where you're not going to get a one punch. You may get a 1-2 punch. And then you take a look at these two sort of climate activities, and then you realize you're in the middle of a pandemic with an administration that can't, you know, tie its shoelaces. This is another sort of layer of problems that will impact the entire country.
Yeah, I mean, the natural disasters have become so commonplace and so, they've always been devastating when they happen. But, you know, the forest fires in California, it feels like it's every other month, they're breaking another record for the largest or one of the largest fires they've ever seen. And it's really, this one, I think, has been driven a lot by lightning strikes, not campfires or people camping. It's actual natural phenomenon, the tremendous heat in California over the last few weeks. And, you know, and then certainly the Gulf and the Southeast coast of the United States.
And the warmth of the water because of climate change.
Everything. It's making these events more destructive than ever in terms of their human toll. And then you have now the compounding factor of how do you deal with not having super spreader events if people have to be put in shelters as a result of evacuating. Then you have sort of the political overlay. Donald Trump's not a big fan of California. He said recently that, you know, he mentioned again this idea that they haven't done enough to rake up leaves in the forest. Remember, he heard that from a Scandinavian leader a while back. He brought it back up again. He's still very upset that they haven't raked enough in California. So all of that is just tremendously problematic at a level that we haven't seen before. And just real quick, just to mention on your earlier point about the economic impacts, it's not only the schools themselves, it's the surrounding communities. There was a fascinating article in the Philadelphia Inquirer about State College, Pennsylvania, where Penn State is, and the impact of the university on hotels, restaurants, convenience stores, everything. And we're talking, millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in lost revenue for a lot of these businesses with no football, with limited access to campus, et cetera.
Well, no, it's like you throw a stone in the water and you watch the ripple effect, and that's exactly what we're seeing. And again, you want to tell that story, because that story isn't a story of do you open school or close school. It's the consequences of all those things. Now, Bob, I want to go to you, because part of the reason I brought up the fires, for example, in California, is that I pointed out on Facebook that it touches three things. It touches the pandemic, COVID. It touches climate change. It also touches criminal justice. And the reason I say that is that we know that the spread of COVID in state penitentiaries and prisons around around the country has been ridiculous. And they've lost people and they are COVID positive. But what people don't realize is how many of these prisoners, in quotes, are actually firefighters during the time of this kind of situation you're seeing in California. And now what they have is the worst fires, the fewest number of people available to fight the fires, and they can't go into the prisons and pull out the prisoners because of the spread of COVID within the prisons, because they haven't addressed that problem and they haven't prevented it from sort of spreading within those institutions. You've got a trifecta going on now, Bob, and they are looking at cities that are possibly going to be torched. I mean, every time we talk about a big fire, we talk about maybe 100 homes or that small community that was badly damaged. But they are looking now not at small communities, but at the potential of what's going to happen with cities. And of course, what's happening now with all the smoke and the pandemic affecting your lungs. I mean, the synergistic effect is frightening, Bob.
And I think the thing that got my attention was when Governor Newsom said they were talking about 130 degree temperatures.
Yes.
So when you have that as an ambient air temperature, you're into something entirely different. And what you describe here is the unraveling of a social ecology of labor. And that's happening across the board. And it's also, at the same time, those of us who cover the TikTok of civil service, and that is the people that get up every day and do this work, is the reality that we're finding so many people that aren't dying and are surviving COVID, but are going to be permanently disabled. And so we've already lost 1,000 healthcare workers, and we will probably lose another 1,000 by election day.
Yeah.
And so that's just healthcare. In New York City, we lost 300 civil servants in addition to 100 and I guess 50, 60 people in the transit system. And I'm sure there's going to be as many people that have long-term health consequences. So that's why these body blows continue. And we're still not even taking inventory of it. We're not even aware of it. It's still being described as, well, I beat the COVID, and not looking at these systemic issues.
Well, but Rick, one of the stories I was reading from the Mercury News was, I mean, this guy was out of his mind because he doesn't have the help. He doesn't have the support. He's seeing, you know, temperatures, as Bob mentioned, you know, he's seeing fire spreading in ways they've never seen before. He doesn't have it. And so I was reading a comment under one of the articles, and they said, so you fought the fire. You're giving yourself 2 or 3 hours of sleep. You're sleeping in these incredible conditions where you're literally nose to nose because there isn't space. You're all exhausted, so you're breathing even more heavily. They can't even imagine if anyone has COVID in that setting, what is going to happen to the desperately needed firefighters that are fighting these fires. So it's like this, it's this vicious cycle of afraid of losing your life from the fire, but then afraid of getting COVID because you're fighting the fire because you don't know about the guy sitting next to you because no one's had time for a test. Nobody has time for this. And frankly, that's the last thing on your mind when you see this fire racing across California and destroying 1 million acres already, everyone. 1 million acres, Rick.
Well, you know, there's another layer here, and Dean touched on it, I think. It's the political layer. Look, 62 years old, I've followed politics since 1972. So I've, you know, been through Nixon, Ford, Carter. I don't recall ever anybody, no, regardless of party, who viewed the country through the lens of red state, blue state. You know, we've heard Mitch McConnell say things like, we're not going to bail out failed blue state governors. We've heard the president say the same thing. When I see things like what's happening in California, you've got to be saying, is there some diminished response from the federal government because Trump knows that's not his state? He views California as that has nothing to do with me. Now that you've got Kamala Harris in for certain, I don't need to help California.
That's right.
You know, but, you know, if it was happening in Alabama, I'd be there. If it's happening in Florida, I'd be there. We've got to be concerned about that. That's horrific that we have a situation where even that thought comes into the political bloodstream.
But let me just say something, Dean. So there's nothing wrong with Alabama, Mississippi, or Tennessee, or Kentucky. But California would be if it was a country. I think the sixth richest or most prolific country in the world. I mean, California is huge. I don't think Donald Trump quite understands how important California is to the national economy. So again, as he writes it off because it's a blue state, as he writes it off because it's Kamala's state, as he writes it off for all these things, I don't think there is an appreciation or an understanding of how consequential the economy of California is to all of us. So this is a story that has so much, that has economic ramifications on top of all the personal and lives that are gonna be lost. And frankly, I'm gonna be honest with you. I have a friend who called me from California and her husband has Parkinson's. So he's already sort of slightly health damaged. The smoke that is pouring in to her community. She can't keep the windows open. It is difficult to walk outside. And she is like 100 miles, 200 miles from a fire. But that hasn't stopped the smoke from overwhelming. People are now beginning to think, where do I go? Where do I go? That means leaving California. That is another problem for all of us because we're always talking about the refugees and everyone keeps thinking about Mexico and Latin America. We're going to have now these climate refugees, people that are coming from places like California and frankly, even Texas at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think Trump's decision rule has always been, do they like me or do they not like me? And that's kind of where we start. He's also found it very useful when it serves his purposes to either leave it to the states to avoid any assigning of responsibility, or if it's in his interest to order to say he has the power under Article 2 to do whatever it is he wants to do and order everyone to do it. Now, we've seen that governors have gotten pretty good at ignoring his various pronouncements. You know, the opening of schools is the obvious example. He, basically the governors are just doing whatever they think makes sense for their state, despite his constant threats of withholding funding. So, he's thinking mainly in terms of electoral politics, the Electoral College, and focusing his energy and largesse on places that he thinks can help him win, whether it's Florida or Pennsylvania or some other swing state. But California, he just really doesn't have any use for.
Well, I think, do you like me or do you not like me is exactly, that's the essence of the Donald Trump sort of ethic, you know? And that's why, yeah. The one
who
won, Bob, from
QAnon. Said it last week with
QAnon. QAnon, exactly. Well, I think, They like me. That's exactly right. They like me. Oh my God. Rick, yes.
Could
Rick?
I just jump in? When his brother passed away, I thought one of the most telling comments I've ever heard Trump say. He said, "My brother Robert was a great guy. He wasn't jealous of my greatness."
He said that?
Donald Trump said that. And I just thought to myself, that should be his epitaph.
Oh, he wasn't jealous of my
greatness. That sums up Donald Trump.
Oh my God. I mean, I want that in a bumper sticker. I mean, that's just unbelievable. So Bob, as I'm listening to all of this, I'm just sort of horrified. But I want to get and end this sort of half hour by talking a little bit about what is the most important thing. And again, I'm going to go back to the Democratic Convention, which is a kind of where we started. And it gets me into where I really want to go. And that the most important thing about the Democratic Convention was that it wasn't policy driven. It did soften the edges. It was this proverbial, it was this hug. It was lovely. The theme of the Democratic Convention, however, Bob, was one word. You know what the word is? Vote.
Right.
That was the, if anything was Velcro, if anything was stated and stated over and over again, and it is about the vote that we're going to see the biggest fight between the Trump Party and the Democratic Party. Because Donald Trump hates the vote. He wants to either question the vote, he wants to delay the vote, he wants to destroy the vote, he wants to accuse it of fraud, he is dismantling the Postal Service, and it is. I mean, what's going on with the USPS is just amazing, because what I need to share with you, Bob, is that I interviewed a reporter from ProPublica, and I interviewed him before we were dismantling the USPS with a Postmaster DeJoy. He had spent a year following things at the post office, they were already delays. They were already consolidating. They were already shutting down certain sorting machines before they were ordered to take out even more sorting machines. So he was talking about the delays in place before DeJoy got in. So they were having problems that nobody really wanted to talk about. And then you compound what was already sort of weakened within a system. And then you pull out all the stops and you take away post boxes and you destroy, literally destroy sorting machines.
What happened was that they peaked too early. I have been covering the Postal Union as part of my mandate portfolio at the chief leader for a few 4 years now. And to be fair, this obsession by even some neoliberals within the Democratic Party of moving towards privatization, that thing was getting traction for a while. The story I mentioned last time about the uniformed U.S. Postal Police of 500 members, primarily officers of color, when they began to tell them to stop their patrols in the community against mail fraud and just stay inside the physical perimeter of the post office facilities in 2017. You have to look at this. It's almost like we have a hostile foreign power inside the Oval Office committed to dismantling the United States 24/7. This isn't just the post office. Yeah. I have been reporting on, from the very beginning he came in, the attempt to drive federal unions out of the workplace where 2 million people work. So what people are not, you know, you have to look at Donald Trump as an employer and the way he spread COVID by not providing testing and masks for 2 million federal workers across the United States, including TSA in the front lines when they had the panic at the airports, in the Bureau of Prisons, in the Veterans Administration congregant facilities, where to this day, they will not do proactive testing. And then you have, so this has been a war on the civil service since this guy got in.
I know. And the story of the, Rick, the story, the reason I want to go back to this sort of the idea of the war on the post office is because of the story from Manchester, New Hampshire. Let me just read a couple of sentences from this article. A Pennsylvania man who bought a mail sorter from the Manchester post office at auction said he has been told he can no longer have the machine. Charlie Price said he arrived at the Manchester post office 2 weeks ago to pick up the machine, but he's leaving empty-handed. He said he hired three men to help him dismantle the 30-ton mail sorting machine that he bought on an online auction for, sitting down, everyone, a whopping $2,000. Oh my God, this is like incredible. And then he goes on to say he was told the reason these items were up for auction, oh, these were auctioned off weeks ago, was that there was a national program within the Postal Service to downsize the entire system by 20%, Rick.
Yeah.
So he buys a sorting machine for $2,000.
Yeah, a couple of things here. First, isn't that typical? And that, whether it's, you know, whether it's Trump, frankly, or any other, you know, administration. So this guy, he's just some small business guy in Pennsylvania, figured out, you know, I could take that stuff and strip it down. I resell it for $20,000.
Exactly.
And with my cost, you know, you guys probably going to make 12, 14 grand for a week or two's work. Not a bad gig for him. But why doesn't someone in the federal government say, well, if we're going to do that, why don't we do that and make the money ourselves? The second comment, though, that the first when I read that story was, how typical is this of Donald Trump? I mean, this is what he does. He buys things and then he dismantles them. He destroys them. I mean, the Eastern Airlines shuttle was one of the most profitable, one of the most, you know, well used and served shuttle services in the country. You know, he picked it up, put gold toilets on it, and a couple of years later, it was gone. You know, that's another thing that could be just a symbol. You for the federal government selling equipment that's going to be dismantled as opposed to reused.
Yeah. So as I'm talking about this mailing and the challenge of mailing and the confusion of mailing and the absentee balloting and then the vote by mail. And then, you know, can you still hand it in the day before? I mean, there is chaos in part, Dean, not only because of what's happening with the Postal Service, not only because of the drumbeat of fraud coming out of Donald Trump, but people have never done this before. This is not, I mean, it's typical in some states where they have voted by mail. It is typical for some people who may on a regular basis have to be out of town, or they may have some sort of a physical disability, but that's been a tiny handful of people, like in my state. people get these things and they don't realize, I got to sign here, I got to sign there, I got to do it under penalty of perjury. How many days do I have to put it in? So this is a skill set that people have never had before during an election that's never had more meaning before. And I saw an article, and I mean, the only way Donald Trump leaves Dean Spiliotis is if he gets clobbered in this election. But everything about the election is making it so it is almost difficult to imagine how that could happen, given all the roadblocks to actually exercising the franchise. And it's not just the pandemic. It's not just closing down the number of voting sites. It what does it mean by mail? And what happens if I sign in the wrong place or I don't sign twice? You know what I mean? Then they throw out my ballot. But you had every intent of voting. You know, you just never knew because no one instructed you. This wasn't part of your civics class that you never had anyway.
Dean? Yeah, you know, it's for sure it's anxiety provoking for people who haven't done this in the past for, as you mentioned, business or other reasons, and or people who live in states where they've kind of perfected this over many years. Also, it's the case that a lot of the folks who are preferring to stay home are older folks who are more likely to be susceptible to complications from COVID. And so they may be used to kind of going to their local polling place for many decades, and maybe they're not comfortable finding information online about how to do this. I think also a lot of people don't realize that this is really a local issue. Everyone kind of looks to the national parties for guidance on this. It's really a state and even local county level in most cases issue. And I think the combination of all those factors and then this whole postal reconfiguration issue, it's causing people a tremendous amount of anxiety. And I know states are, you know, different states have kind of different political infrastructures in place and more or less interest in helping out, different levels of financial resources, et cetera. And so it's a bit of a mess.
It is a bit of a mess. And so, Bob, I'm going to sort of let you do the stem winder at the end. And as we're looking at this Republican convention coming in, I'm trying to figure out how to watch. I'm trying to figure out whether I should take two Valium as I'm sitting there and I'm watching it, because I'm not sure that the anger and the description of the country I'm going to hear is a country I recognize. And I'm not sure that I can handle all the blame that is going to be spread around. And usually you think about elections as an opportunity to talk about hope and promise. And I feel like this is going to be a week that I think Biden had it right, of incredible darkness.
Well, I think that what they have done here is really undermined this postal attack. Has a profound impact on rural areas. And I've lived in some remote places, Leonard Peninsula in Michigan. And so places that Trump had relied on for that very small margin, he's now, that's a body blow. That's a place you have veterans and people that are relying on medication. And so I think he's kind of done something here that, you know, like I say, I think going for the very public thing of collecting their mailboxes and then showing the picture of the sorting machines by the dumpster. And as we speak, when this airs, there'll be the high profile hearings before the House Oversight Committee. I do think this is an opportunity for people not to organize around the things that we used to take for granted. And there's a post office everywhere. And there's now this bonding that's occurring that I'm seeing happening spontaneously, where people are talking to postal people and engaging in a really Norman Rockwell kind of way.
That's Donald Trump. I love you. This is absolutely, so not only do I talk to my postman, I mean, like ad nauseum, it's like unbelievable. But he
people
said to me, did you see the
stamps like they're investing in the post office?
Oh God, no, they are. He's absolutely right. People are actually saying, I just bought $100 worth of stamps. It's like really funny, Rick.
Bring back postal banking.
Well, right. They are talking about postal banking, but the last but not least, everyone has been spreading around that picture of the dead chicks that came to the farmer in Maine. They have been sending baby chicks through the mail for decades. And because of the delays, these chicks are now arriving at poultry farms and they're dead. And if anything works with voters, it's a dead chick. And on that note,
add something close to truth versus lies, and that is with the New Hampshire sorting machine, the reason that they gave, the Postal Service, when they told this man that he couldn't come and pick up and take the machine that he had already bought and paid for, was because there's an order from DeJoy, the Postmaster General, that says no further action will be taken at all that has anything to do with the equipment, the sorting machines. So I remember thinking when he said that, oh, good, there, and I think a lot of the people did too, he's going to stop doing the bad things that he's doing. But he must have realized that people could come buy the machines and then actually use them to help UPS to deliver the mail. So you can't really trust what he's going to tell Congress in the next couple of days.
Well, what he says is very interesting. I'm going to stop, but that doesn't mean I'm going to return the post boxes. I'm going to return the sorting machines. I mean, he told the guy he couldn't pick it up. That doesn't mean they're going to plug it back in. I'm just telling you right now.
They're reinstalling them. And some workers are taking it upon themselves to reinstall them in some locations.
Under authority, or are they just reinstalling them?
Direct action.
Direct action.
Are they going
to
be
on
fired?
That note, I have to take direct action and end this hour of Rethink the Week on the Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes, Rick Newman, Robert Henley, Dean Spiliotis. Thank you so much for an interesting conversation, and I can't wait till next week. Ooh, ooh, ooh. All right, everyone. Be safe. Be well. Ciao.
Thanks, everyone.
Must have lunch real soon. Your luggage is checked through. We've got inflation licked. I'll get right back to you. It's just a standard form. Tomorrow without fail. Pleased to meet you. Thanks a lot. Your check is in the mail. Marooned, marooned, marooned in a blizzard of lies. Marooned, marooned, marooned in a blizzard of lies. Toes and knees aren't all you'll freeze when you're in it up to your thighs. It looks like snow, but you never know when you're marooned in a blizzard of lies. You may have won a prize, won't wrinkle, shrink, or peel. Your secret's safe with me. This is a real good deal. It's finger licking good, strictly by the book. What's fair is fair, I'll be right there. I am not a crook. Marooned, marooned, marooned in a blizzard of lies.